And tonight we're going to talk about remote viewing and the paranormal world as well with two special guests. And I tell you what we're going to be doing. Robert Knight's going to join us in a moment. We're going to be talking about his work and his experience. He's also been a photographer for rock stars for more than 40 years. Later on at the half this hour, Angela Thompson Smith joins us on Coast to Coast. We will talk about her world and remote viewing. Next hour, they will both join us together, and then we'll take calls with them in the final hour of the show. All that's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Robert Knight has been photographing rock stars for more than 40 years. One of the first professional photographers to shoot the late Jimi Hendrix and the last to photograph Stevie Ray Vaughan. Knight has been in the business since 1968. He has created a sprawling archive of classic rock and roll stills, including the likes of Led Zeppelin, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Carlos Santana, just to name a few. And Robert, of course, claims that many rock stars have had UFO encounters, including, of course, Sammy Hagar. Robert's professional life chronicled in the documentary film Rock Prophecies. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Robert, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. Good evening.
You know, you're a friend of our friend, Billy Gibbons. You can't be all that bad.
And the dear Reverend is a dear friend of mine.
He once told us that Jimi Hendrix was the best guitar player he had ever heard.
I think Billy believes that. He definitely met Jimi right at the very beginning, and Jimi took a shine into him. And he actually sent me a photo one day of his first band without beards. And there was Jimi Hendrix in the middle of them. They were called the Moving Sidewalks.
How did you get into this, photographing these rock stars?
Well, it was a lot of synchronicity in my life. I grew up in Hawaii. My father was a Baptist minister, and we lived in a very weird part of Honolulu called Palolo Valley, which was weird if you happen to be a Haole. And I wasn't allowed to listen to rock music, go to movies. It was a very strict Southern Baptist kind of family. And one day I found these magazines in Waikiki that some tourists had left behind. And in there were these pictures of these very unusual-looking people with long hair and strange clothes. And they had these funny names like The Who, The Yardbirds, and, you know, The Kinks, and The Rolling Stones. And there was a catalog where you could send away for that music. And I got these phenomenal albums with these unbelievable visuals on the cover. And I thought, wow, I want to be part of this. And when I was 16 years old, I went to London and accidentally found myself on the set of a movie where they were making about a rock star and, you know, photography.
Sure.
I think it was called Blow Up. And that gave the little bell in my head to go off. I went back to Hawaii, became a photographer, and then the Vietnam War was happening. My parents wanted me to go to college. And I saw that Bill Graham, in the summer of 1968, had Jeff Beck, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, and I told my parents, this is where I needed to go to school. So I went to the San Francisco Art Institute and had Annie Leibovitz as a classmate.
Wow.
And I spent most of my time at the Fillmore shooting the bands. And I convinced Rolling Stone editor Jan Weiner to send me to Los Angeles to shoot an incarnation of the Yardbirds that nobody had heard of. I went down to the Whiskey-A-Go-Go and found out that I was way too young to get in. I wasn't 21. And they called the band, and it turned out to be Led Zeppelin. And I shot their first show in America, and we became friends. And I called the promoter in Hawaii, and I said, book this band. He did. I flew back to Hawaii, and it sort of started from there. Within my first year, I'd worked with most of what we would consider today the A-list guitar players.
That's fantastic. I mean, I've looked at your work on your website, robertmknight.com. Phenomenal work.
I mean, you
get angles that nobody can get. I mean, you really... How do you like digital as opposed to film?
Well, I mean, I went there reluctantly, but, you know, I would have turned into a dinosaur had I stuck with film, so I totally embraced it. And the Nikon company has been my partner through the last few years. They've helped me with the digital cameras, and now I fully embrace it and quite enjoy using it.
And they're convenient now, aren't they?
Very. And it's just astonishing because when I think back, if I would have had this technology when I shot Jimi Hendrix, imagine the photos I'd have today.
Oh, my gosh.
I can shoot thousands.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays, Robert, as you know, you can take the picture and look at it and say, I don't like that. I'm going to do this again. And in the old days, man, you shot it. That was it. You had to just keep shooting.
Feedback. You had no feedback. You had to instantly know whether or not you got the picture. Nope. You had to wait a week sometimes.
Now, tell me then how this turned into your interest in the unusual and the paranormal.
Well, when I met Jimi Hendrix, because, you know, being in Hawaii, bands either would start tours there or end tours, and there was a lot of downtime, and they would hang out. So I spent a lot of time with Led Zeppelin. I spent a lot of time with Jimi Hendrix, Alice Cooper, and this topic kept coming up. And I had a very strange experience when I was very young in Hawaii, and I was always looking for answers. So when I met people that would talk about these sort of things, I became very interested. They would give me information. Jimmy Page was he had like one of the largest, you know, kind of what you would call an occult bookstore in England at the time called Equinox. And he was telling me about some of the books he had. And it just kept propelling and growing. And I would hear these stories. And I finally met a band called Skinny Puppy. And Ogre was the lead singer. And they were one of the first industrial bands before Nine Inch Nails. And Ogre wanted to create a kind of internet conspiracy UFO kind of site with Rick Rubin. And he had me come in, and Ogre and I went after Ed Dames. We had heard he had just gone into a sort of private sector. We sent him emails, and he reached out to me. And that started this connection that led to me being at the first IRVA meeting and all of the fathers and founders of remote viewing I managed to track down, interview, and speak with.
You know John Alexander as well.
Very well.
Good guy.
Yeah, after helping Ed, he introduced John to me, and I did some photos for a couple of John's books, and in a sense, this is kind of what saved me from being arrested for murder, actually.
And we'll get into that.
Yes.
You also had a chance to meet Ingo Swann.
Yes, I've spent a long time with Ingo, and I'm in fact doing a documentary on Ingo and his life as the father of remote viewing, and have tracked down all the people involved with the program that are still living, from Hal Putoff to Jack Vallee to Kit Green, and I've got amazing interviews, and these people have probably for the first time told a lot of the background story.
That's exciting. Did you ever meet, or did Ingo mention to you, my aunt at the time, and this would have been years ago, Robert, mm-hmm. Shafika Caregula?
No, I don't know
okay.
that name.
He loved her. In a professional sense.
Yeah.
And she was a psychiatrist who gave up her business to go into investigating telepathy and the unusual.
Wow.
And she got to know Ingo, and they collaborated. They were very close. She died in Los Angeles when a radio fell in her tub when she was taking a bath.
Oh, my God. That's unbelievable.
And then that was it for her.
Yeah.
So when you said Ed was Dr. Doom was so receptive, did he help you, or how did he pull you along?
Well, it was quite interesting because Ed, when I first made contact with him, contacted me from Albuquerque, flew out to Los Angeles, and he said, I kind of remote viewed you, and you have something you need to tell me. There's something you bring to remote viewing. What is it? And we were talking, and I said, have you ever heard of Art Bell? And he said, what's an Art Bell? And I said, well, you know, if you went on Art Bell and you talked about this, this is the audience that would embrace this.
They would understand. That's right.
So I called Norio Hayakawa, and I said, Norio, can you get a hold of Art Bell? And Ed went on that night.
That night?
That night.
And you know what? They loved each other after
yes.
that.
Yeah. And you know, I then said to Ed, because he said, you know, what else could I do? What else should we do? And I said, could you train remote viewing on videotape? He said, great idea.
You gave him that
idea.
That's
history.
That's
it.
He's doing that all the time now.
Right. So he said, what can I do to help you? And I said, introduce me to John Alexander. So I got to meet John Alexander, helped him with some photography for some of his books. And he said, what can I do to help you? And I said, I want to meet Ingo Swann. He said, Ingo doesn't like to meet new people. It took me 4 attempts. He refused to meet me.
He's very private.
Very private. And finally, I was on my way to Europe to meet my wife, and I was laying over in New York, and I said, John, would you call Ingo one more time? So he called Ingo, and Ingo said, tell Robert I'm old, I'm fat, and no one loves me. And I said, John, call him back and tell him I'm fat, I'm old, and no one loves me either. And he agreed to see me.
And it happened.
It happened, and it was a remarkable first meeting.
Robert, what do you think of remote viewing?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I've been around it for a very long time, and I'm not a remote viewer. You would have thought I would have been. I've never been trained. My wife's been trained. People around me have been trained. And at first I was skeptical because I was like, how can this be? But when I met Hal Putoff and he explained to me about quantum physics and quantum entanglement, and how two things not connected in space and time can be connected, that I started to understand the physics or the science behind it. And there's definitely a physics and a science behind remote viewing.
There sure is. I've practiced it. I think I'm getting a little better each time I do it.
Yes.
But it still baffles me. I think there's this wireless internet connection out there in the universe.
Yes.
And we're all tied into it somehow. And the way it works is just absolutely mind-boggling, isn't it?
I don't know if you've ever had Dr. Michael Persinger as a guest, but I interviewed him on the Ingo documentary, and he has the most wonderful explanation to it all. And where all the Earth's magnetic biosphere is holding all the information, past, present, and future, and how you tap into it.
I would agree with that. We're going to bring in Angela in a half hour and talk with her, and then later on, in about 30 minutes, both of you are going to get together and we'll talk about how you found her.
Yes.
And that has got to be one of the most bizarre stories.
It's bizarre, but it's probably one of the most amazing real-time remote viewing things in a long time, where, you know, information went from Angela to me to the police and something happened immediately.
Tell me a little bit of these UFO encounters that so many rock stars have. I mean, is this an unusually high percentage of people who see things?
Well, I think, you know, when I first started, you know, and I can make an unbelievable list of people that I'm around that have told me stories, from Aerosmith to Elton John, Robbie Williams, Billy Gibbons. I mean, it's unbelievable. But there's something about musicians that are already kind of open to a different kind of reality, because when they write music or they play music, they seem to tap into something that they're channeling. So I think they're receptive to ideas or situations, or, as Ingo says, they have a much larger reality box. But also, musicians seem to have more power on the planet at the moment than politicians, because in my mind, someone like U2 had a lot more to do with why apartheid ended in South Africa than politicians. Because Bono would go on and on and on about it. And the same thing with the poor young lady that was being held captive in Burma. He, every night, would go on about this. There was so much pressure through the rock musicians. So they become very influential. So I think if there's an outside force that wants to influence generations of younger people, why not do it through musicians?
Sure, absolutely. And
I think there's something there.
And they seem very open to this.
Yes. And Sammy Hagar has told me these stories, and his thing was repetitive over and over and over. Wasn't a one-time thing. And he's very lucid. I mean, I saw Sam the other night, and it's like, these people, it's very real, and some of it, I actually have a few A-list people that don't even want their name mentioned because they're ashamed they'll be ridiculed.
Well, not on this show, but you're right.
But they don't know how to wrap their head around it. And others have been a little bit more vocal. Robbie Williams, who's become a really good friend of mine, he's had astonishing things happen right in Los Angeles.
Have you found that they are pretty spiritual, most of these rock stars?
You know, because of my generation, the 60s, they seem more self-realized than the younger generation. I've been kind of working on a potential television show about this very topic. And the networks are saying, well, can't you reach out to some younger people as well? And when I've talked to much younger musicians, they kind of look at me cross-eyed, because I don't think they become self-realized as easy or as early in their lives as some of the guys from the 60s, like the Stones and David Bowie. And all these people have these amazing sightings.
Well, they sure have.
Yeah.
And I guess it's because, as you say, they're pretty receptive. They're tuned in. Have you ever met one of these rock stars you didn't like?
No, because I only chose to the ones I like. I mean, I've really not had anybody I could say there is a really bad person. They're all unbelievable, and it's like a family now. I see Aerosmith now on a regular basis, and it's just like, you know, I know their children, and it's generational, and it's just like one big family. I still see Elton John from time to time, or Jeff Beck.
Oh, that's
Gibbons.
Cool.
You know, they're still around.
Well, you see Elton, tell him Russ Regan says hi.
Oh, the photographer?
Russ is a great guy. Russ was one of those who discovered Elton John.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Now I remember. Yeah.
Good guy. And we had Mike Love on the show last week.
The Beach
he
Boys.
Called in. I mean, that is great, too, just seeing them come back again.
Yeah, I had some friends that saw them in Vegas the other night, and they said it was truly amazing.
They are so exciting. Yeah. They really are. Well, now, the world of the paranormal for you, how far do you take this now? What else will you be doing with this?
Well, I've traveled being a photographer. I also had a career as a travel photographer that I didn't tell the rockers about. But I've been to most places on Earth, and I have photographed most of what your fan base there would call the PowerPoints, from the pyramids to the Balinese temples to Chichen Itza to Malta. And you see this profound thing happening all over the world, and you think, these people weren't supposed to be talking to each other. There didn't seem to be a connection, and yet there are similar stories and similar connections all over the planet in the ancient days. I just finished a trip to Cambodia a few months ago, and I was shocked at this temple complex and the mathematics and the things that are involved in the building of this. There had to have been some outside help or information being channeled to these people.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah, so then, you know, I've kind of combined that with the music thing, and it's just sort of keeps propelling me. And people like John and Hal and Ingo and Kit Green, they've all introduced me to other people. I've met the most amazing set of people through these guys. And, you know, I've talked to Ed Mitchell, and I've talked to, you know, some of the top people out at Los Alamos.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, you know, what's happening in quantum physics and astronomy. It's just amazing right now.
Mitchell is one of the greatest guys, isn't he?
Yeah, he was really, really good.
Super. He really is. And Robert, in this new era of things that are happening, I mean, what do you think of like the TMZs that are out there at every restaurant, every airport? I mean, every person is holding a little video cam. Is that too much?
It is too much, but there's an insatiable appetite of the American public for this kind of pop culture. And I keep trying to distinguish myself as not a paparazzi photographer. And it's very funny when I see someone like Tommy Lee, who gets into scuffles with photographers, I always say, Tommy, do you remember me? He goes, yes, Robert, I won't hit you.
But, I mean, do you carry your camera with you when you're out, when you go to a restaurant?
Believe it or not, no.
Okay.
I honestly don't. I have an iPhone, you know, I mean, that's everybody's a photographer now, right? But generally, the reason I've got along with a lot of these people is I know when not to take the camera.
That's right.
You know, because you can't be just shooting all the time, and it will be quite annoying, and I've actually become friendly with them. So, like Jimi Hendrix, I spent a lot of time with him, but he was in a bathing suit, and he didn't want to be photographed.
Yeah. Well, they know you're not going to invade their privacy.
Yeah, I think after 40-something years, they sort of trust me now.
Yeah, exactly. But that's something, Robert, that has gone away.
Yes.
You know, that type of ethic that right. has been there between photographer, journalist, and, you know, when you do shoot them, you're also a journalist in a yes. photographic sense. You don't find that anymore.
No, and, you know, there's more money to be had in taking a bad photo of somebody than a good photo. If you get someone doing something naughty or they're picking their nose or something, it seems to generate yeah. more money for these folks.
I mean, what do they pay these people to shoot things like that?
I can tell you, I know of a photographer that got a pretty much exclusive picture of Paris Hilton in the back of a police car, crying handcuffed when she was arrested.
Okay.
And probably made, over the course of 2 months, $600,000.
No!
So when you see this kind of money... Well,
I'm going out to get my Nikon.
I know. I mean, these people make, you know, they rent helicopters, they'll stalk you, and it's a frenzy who can get these kind of shots, and I don't want to be part of that group.
That is amazing, because, you know, you very easily could. Now, it would hurt you with your reputation with everybody,
yeah.
but $600,000 for Paris Hilton?
You know, I mean, you can get a $250,000 for the right shot on the cover of some of the magazines and newspapers in Europe. It's unbelievable.
Is that what motivates them?
Yes.
And they just keep pushing.
Okay, I mean, obviously not every picture generates that, but if you get the home run picture, you get something that's in the news and no one else gets it. This is why there's the frenzy of photographers.
Let me give out your website here, Robert. It's robertmknight.com. We've got it linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to bring in Angela Thompson-Smith in a moment. We're going to talk with her about remote viewing and what she has done. And then at the top of the hour, Robert and Angela will both be on. There's a connection between those two, and we'll have Robert tell you about that when he comes back with her. And then later on, we'll take phone calls about everything we're talking about. Remote viewing, what's it like to be photographing a rock star? You name it. We'll be back with that on Coast to Coast AM. Well, remote viewer Angela Thompson-Smith joins us in just a moment. We're going to talk with her about her work, her book, Remote Perceptions, by the way, and also Diary of an Abduction. Now, you're probably saying, Okay, now what does Robert Knight, the photographer of Rock Group People, have to do with Angela Thompson Smith? Well, next hour you will find out this incredible connection. But let's talk with Angela when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Angela Thompson Smith, PhD, owner of the MindWise Consulting Group, a life coaching business in Boulder City, Nevada. Dr. Smith was a founding member and director of the International Remote Viewing Association. We talk about that a lot. That was back in 1999. Number of years experience in parapsychology and remote viewing fields, including at least five working at the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Center Laboratory and 20 years in the remote viewing field. We're going to talk with Angela about remote viewing for about 20-some minutes and then team her together with Robert Knight next hour. Angela, how are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Good. You know a lot of people that we all know, John Alexander and all those great folks.
Yep.
They are super. How did you get involved in remote viewing?
When I was working at the PEAR Lab at Princeton, towards the end of the 5 years there, I had a chance to link up with Ed Danes, and he was interested in having people join his team. He had just started up SciTech and was working on a couple of cases, including the Saint-Exupéry plane crash that had crashed at the end of World War II, and they were looking for the downed plane in the ocean off the south coast of France. So I linked up with him, and that was my first formal work with remote viewing.
And you never stopped after that.
Right.
And you did a little work with OBEs as well as a child. You stumbled across some of Robert Monroe's work.
Right. I'd had OBEs since I was a child. And when I was little, I thought everybody had them, like dreams, but I knew they weren't dreams. And then when I was out in Colombia, I worked down in Colombia with a voluntary organization in the 70s. And in a bookshop there, I found Robert Monroe's book, Journeys Out of the Body, and thought, wow, here's somebody like me who's had similar experiences.
You know, I was obsessed with that book, too, at a young age, Angela. He did a great job. Of course, Robert's no longer with us. His institute, though, is still doing its thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, that's a good thing. So as you evolved into this, was this something that you wanted to do as a career, or were you still planning other things?
Well, it was not at the beginning. I had trained as a nurse and social worker in England.
Okay.
I came out to the States and eventually found a job as a medical researcher with Moms and Babies and in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And this was in the 1980s. And I heard about two labs at Princeton, PRL, which is no longer around, the Psychophysical Research Labs that was doing Ganzfeld research, psychic research with a group there. And then also the PEAR Lab at Princeton. And I was very fortunate. I volunteered, first of all. I thought, you know, very different from the work, the regular medical research I was doing with Moms and Babies. So I went down on my days off and holidays and enjoyed it, mm-hmm. and then eventually got hired at PEAR.
It's amazing you have crossed paths with so many incredible people in the fields of remote viewing and consciousness and psychic work. Paul Smith, of course, Lynn Buchanan, great people.
Right. In fact, I've trained in remote viewing with Paul Smith and Lynn Buchanan.
You must be pretty darn good.
Well, I've been at it a long time. I've become practiced. I had an innate ability, I suppose, and with training and practice, I've developed the skill.
Well, you know, your undergrad is in what, psychology?
My undergrad was in psychology at Cardiff University, and then I went to Manchester University in England and did my master's, and then eventually did my PhD with Saybrook in San Francisco.
How much of your background in psychology helped you understand remote viewing, if at all?
Not really. The standard orthodox psychology world really doesn't go there. However, at Saybrook, I was able to tailor my PhD to include a lot of courses. One of my professors was Stanley Gripner, and a consciousness researcher.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Ruth Inge Hines, a shamanic practitioner and professor.
Did you enjoy doing that?
I did, very much.
Any frustrating moments for you? Because, you know, it's a field that if it doesn't hit you right away, you know, if it's hard for people to remote view. I mean, I've seen people, Angela, throw their pens and pencils away. You know,
I've had my off days. Yeah. Part of the frustration, I think, is that it's not an accepted field. When I start telling people about remote viewing, there's a blank look, and they say, oh, this has something to do with satellites.
Yeah, a lot of people who don't listen to this show don't understand what it is.
Mm, yeah.
And then you move out to Las Vegas in, what, 90, 92?
92, yeah, yeah. And it was around that time that I met Robert. And it was a sort of unusual meeting because I was working at that time for Robert Bigelow.
Mm-hmm.
The foundation, and somebody had put up on the internet a roast of all of the characters, all the personalities in the remote viewing field at that time. And Robert was trying to figure out who had put it up and why. And so I had lunch with him and a lot of discussion about the various characters in the field.
He's one of a kind, isn't he?
Oh, he is. He's great.
He's got these little pods up there in space now. I think he'd love to have a hotel up there.
I think that's what he's working towards.
Yeah. You know what? If anybody pulls it off, it'll be him.
I think so. And I'm so happy he's found something that he can really stick, you know, get involved with. And I've heard some great things.
Now, were you working with him? Because he was one of those who helped start the original Coast to Coast type show back years ago with Art Bell, Linda Moulton Howe, and our dear friend George Knapp.
I was there at the inception. Area 2000 was started, I think it was 2003, and it ran for 6 months. We had George and...
Linda.
Linda, yeah, bringing in news. Part of my job was searching out people to appear on the show. It was a weekly show, and bring in, you know, the speakers, and I would search out news on the internet and feed that over to George and Linda. And it was very successful.
And then I think right around then, several years later, then Art said, you know what, let's get this thing syndicated along with Alan Corbett, and off they went.
Right. I think it was at the end of that 6 months, and Mr. Bigelow decided that he didn't want to continue running it, so Ed took it and ran with it.
Small world, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean Art, not Ed.
Yeah.
Art.
No, I know that. I know you meant that. But it is a small world.
It is, yeah. And it's an amazing world. There's some amazing people in the field, and I've been very fortunate. Yeah, I almost feel like a midwife sometimes. I've been in the inception of so many different things with IRVA and Area 2000, etc.
Yeah, tell me about your involvement then with the International Remote Viewing Association. They're you know, good people. They put together great conferences. I've been to one, had a conflict on another, but dedicated organization. How did that all come about?
Back in about 99, there was another small group that was talking about setting up an organization, but really didn't get it off the ground. So there was a group of us. They were past members of the early days of remote viewing with Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ and people from the remote viewing unit, Paul Smith and Lynn Buchanan and Skip Atwater. And myself, because I was becoming more involved with that group, said, hey, why don't we do something? So on a wing and a prayer, we got the first meeting going out at Alamogordo at Linda Cannon's house in 99. And Russell Targ kindly willed over to us his nonprofit, which the IRFA was able then to adapt.
Okay.
Its use. And took off, and of course Robert was there. Robert was the official photographer and narrator for that, I suppose you could say.
Were you surprised, Angela, by the amount of people interested in remote viewing or practicing remote viewing at that time who helped form the organization?
Of course, it was a lot smaller at that time. It's not surprising now because there are so many people. I call them first generation, second generation, third generation of remote viewers who are trained and then train others. So there are perhaps many thousands now around the world.
And it's truly a remarkable gift. I was disappointed when I interviewed so many of these players from the government's program, really to find out how the government got out of it and why. I mean, to me, it sounded like they were pretty successful, weren't they?
I believe so, and from what I've heard, I wasn't in the military unit. I was at PEAR, which was the civilian parallel. It was a matter of politics and oversight, and people that just didn't want it continued for various reasons. And but from what I've seen and the work I've seen come out of the unit. They did some remarkable work. I mean, sure, Paul Smith talked about some of the cases.
I mean, I'm baffled that the government didn't at least clandestinely continue it of some way.
Well, maybe it has.
You know, well, you know, I asked Paul Smith that once, Angela, and I mean, they were all the best of the best. I mean, yeah. So I kept saying, okay, if they've got this clandestine program going, a Black Ops remote viewing program, shouldn't they be using you guys? And, you know, he said, well, you would think so, but he doesn't think it's ongoing. And then I said, Paul, you sure you're telling me the truth? Thinking maybe he's still part of it, but I don't think they are. I think it's truly been disbanded, hasn't it?
That the Stargate unit, and you know, had multiple names, I'm sure, you know, was disbanded, but who's to say that something else or others, other groups have since been put into
action. Now, what are you doing now in the field of remote viewing these days?
I work as a consultant. I've just finished a contract in December. I worked for 9 years for a businessman, Manhattan businessman, business remote viewing. Helped him sell his business during the downtime. In fact, predicted the 2008 recession for him. He's since now retired out to Australia, and which was a great loss. I really enjoyed working with him, and he helped me push the envelope of my own skills. I'm working with people like Robert. I don't do a huge amount of missing people cases, but I have a group of people I've trained around the country that I can call on at various times. And, for example, we did search and rescue remote viewing of when there was the Haiti earthquake.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And that were missing. So we used our skills to assist.
Do you get called on by law enforcement for help, or do you volunteer and go to them first?
I don't volunteer. I usually get called on from time to time. And I prefer that because there are so many people that volunteer information that the law enforcement can become overwhelmed.
No doubt. And you have become an ordained shaman. What's that? shaman, I know. An ordained shaman, I haven't heard of before.
Yeah, well, it's like any other religious or spiritual practice. And I've been training with Hank Wesselman and Jill Kuykendall, and they're out of Hawaii. And I've been working with them now for a couple of years. And I had to go through a vetting process with a group up in Massachusetts before I was ordained. And I can actually now hold weddings if I wanted to.
But who gets married? Remote viewers?
Oh, no. People who don't want a more traditional wedding.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, the rock star.
Yeah.
He's an ordained minister.
Wow.
I mean, he can marry people as well.
Yeah. Well, it involves more than just being able to marry people. It's being a service to the community.
Do you go to Hawaii often?
No, I have been out. I've been out to California mostly for the course. Hank and Jill come out to California, so it's where I've been doing workshops with them.
I think Hank's on the Big Island, isn't he?
Yes, yeah.
That's where our studio is, because I'm going to get together with him when I go out there.
Both of them are fantastic folks.
Yeah, they really are.
Very interesting.
When you do your remote viewing, as you said, you were a business remote viewer. What do they want you to remote view? The competition? What?
Excuse me. Sure. I'm just getting over laryngitis.
That's not good when you're on the radio, but you're doing great.
Okay, thank you. For example, if my client was if he had a meeting set up, and he would want to know, you know, what to prepare, I would, in essence, do a remote viewing and go to the meeting ahead of time for him. And he would ask certain questions about what to prepare, would there be any surprises, who would be there, what would be discussed, etc. So doing remote viewing, that way I could assist him in preparing for the meeting.
Okay. So, and you get him that information enough where he was able to sell his business.
Right, yes. As each buyer came in a very difficult financial time, I was able to assess some of the businesses for him using remote viewing.
Do you see that as a common tool, or is that unusual?
I think it's fairly unusual. There are not a lot of people doing this kind of work, but it's becoming more frequent and more common.
I mean, if I owned a bar, for example, or a restaurant, and you know, you know, there's a high theft rate in that industry, could you be hired as someone to spy on the employee? I don't want to use the word spy, but to look at them to see if they're stealing and things like that?
You can use remote viewing for employee assessment and for crime prevention and assessment. It can be used in very practical ways.
That's pretty exciting, though.
I just take it as ordinary.
It's better than putting up hidden cameras, isn't it?
Right, but again, remote viewing is not 100%.
No, it's but would you say your accuracy rate is pretty high?
I'm about 78%.
That's extremely high, I think, isn't it?
It's not the 80% that some have, but it's certainly not 100% that some claim, but it's pretty good.
Angela, do you use remote viewing for yourself?
No, because part of it is I feel that there's, you know, certain paths that we take, and it's better not to know too far ahead. I find it difficult to view for myself, but I do get hunches, and I do use something called future memory, where I try and listen to myself from the future. It's something that Lynn Buchanan had talked about, where you send yourself back messages about a potential outcome.
How does our future look, by the way?
Pretty much the same as it's. I think it's still going to be a gradual decline, rather than up to the years. Yeah.
Well, maybe a whip around one day and things get better?
It'll be a slow recovery.
Slow indeed. All right, Angela, stay with us. We're going to come back with Angela Thompson-Smith, and Robert Knight joins us. There's a relationship here. There's a reason why they're both on together. You'll find out when we come right back.